Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to learn about why, if you're overweight in midlife, you're going to have a greater opportunity to get Alzheimer's disease later. And Alzheimer's is coming on a lot sooner than it has in the past. Also, why sunflowers are so important for you. Sunflower sprouts and sunflower oil, sunflower nut butter. And a Japanese condiment fights highly lethal pancreatic cancer. Some brand new information from the evidence-based complementary and alternative medicine publication. And how endoscopic procedures are more dangerous than previously thought, and a lot more on health and healing. We're also going to take a look at a lot of other things that we're not paying attention to in our society, and we should. I'm going to take a look at five things that we need to know about how all of our money, we the people's money, has been spent in Afghanistan in the reconstruction. What if I told you there is no reconstruction? And our government, Pentagon, Defense Department, the Inspector General, all have known this. But what has happened is that thousands of individuals have stolen tens of billions of dollars, and no one's held accountable. It's just the cost of doing war and the war profiteers. Yet we are expected to pay our taxes to help all this. Also, what happens is if you're an activist, let's say you're an activist for animal rights or human rights, civil rights, anti-GMOs. According to the latest here, you're on lists, and intelligence services are blocking activist emails, and they're framing them with fake emails. So if any of you have gotten porn on your cell phone and you didn't put it there, you didn't want it, well, there are people doing it to try to put you in a bad situation. I'll share the latest on that, what they're doing against all activists on every issue. Also, my guest in the second part of our program is David Reif. David is a policy analyst specializing in immigration and international military conflicts and humanitarian efforts. And we're going to talk about the political and developmental failures to tackle global poverty and hunger. This is a very important issue for me. Just in the last 12 months, I've been featuring Poverty Inc. in different venues around the United States. I wanted to show people, here's the part of poverty you don't see. It depends upon your circumstances and the context in which you live your lives. Now, I'm not suggesting that anyone should go out of their way to see poverty. I'm suggesting, however, that we should pay attention that we as individuals can do something constructive to help those who are living in poverty. So we're going to discuss this and how, though we throw money at poverty, we don't look at the results, and we should. Plus today, I'm going to share some audio clips, a doctor's simple explanation why cow's milk is not for human consumption. This is a medical doctor. It's a very short clip, but boy, it makes sense. Additionally, I'm going to have Sir Gerald Kaufman, who was a former leading Zionist, who now is speaking out in a different way about the conflicts. And he said something interesting. This is what caught my attention. He was talking about how in a Polish village during World War II, how the Germans came for the Jews, and you were either put onto a train, and those who couldn't make it to the train were simply shot. And how they went in, and while his grandmother was in bed, they simply shot her. And he made a statement, and he gives a statement at the very end of this clip, where he's saying, take a look at what's going on, as he has. Mind you, he was a leading Zionist, and now he has a different perspective on the Israeli and the Palestinian conflict. I'll save that so he can share that with you. And then my last clip of the day will be a young girl, 9 years of age, who had no teachers, no inspirational person to guide her, but on her own decided to take up some singing. And I'll play a little clip, a 2-minute clip of her singing, 9 years old. I think you'll enjoy it. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. And you can watch today's program by going to Ustream channel and just search for Gary Noll. We know now that being overweight is harmful for your health. Here's the problem. No one should be denigrated or mocked or ridiculed, as one person is on the internet right now, by really attacking people who are overweight in some bitterly sarcastic attempted humor. Unless you're in someone's shoes who is overweight, you can't appreciate what they're going through. So part of the image movement, the self-love movement, is to accept yourself and love yourself no matter what your weight or any other condition you may have. And I agree with that. I support that. Here's the limitation. What if you simply get used to being overweight or are making the wrong choices that you're aware of and continue to be overweight, and then you just keep increasing the size of your pants, suits, dresses, and to make yourself comfortable in being overweight? We're assuming as long as you don't have a noticeable classical disease that you're healthy. Wrong. It is not humanly possible. It is not biologically possible. It is not scientifically possible to be obese and be healthy. The problem is you don't know when the consequences of being overweight will manifest. A heart attack, a stroke, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, depression, premature aging. It's all happening. All of that's happening. But there's no time that two people in the same moment, the same second, are going to end up manifesting something. So our mindset is, well, if it hasn't happened yet, I still got time. This is the latest. This is from the National Institute on Aging and a major study published in Molecular Psychiatry. Quote, a thick waistline can give you diabetes, heart disease, joint problems, and cause stroke. But now a new study says being overweight in midlife also raises the risk of Alzheimer's disease at an earlier age. So now they're saying if you're overweight between, let's say, 35 and 50, you're much more likely to have Alzheimer's come earlier. Now, classically defined Alzheimer's is about 5 million people right now in the United States, and I'm guessing at least that amount have early symptoms of Alzheimer's or some form of early dementia, which can lead into Alzheimer's. So you're probably dealing realistically, all told, right now, as I speak, about 15 million individuals in the United States are having problems with their brains. Can we help them? Yes. Have we? Yes. Are we going to? No. For all the reasons you could surmise. A, because unless it's a drug that's patented and promoted within the pharmaceutical medical complex, anything else you do will simply be either denied, avoided, or attacked. But for individuals who are motivated, and there are many, and who themselves are educated about the power of alternative healing, then there's a lot we can do. This is the important lesson here. Quote, maintaining a healthy BMI, which is body mass index, that means the level of fat in your body, at midlife is likely to have long-lasting protective effects. And this is from the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry. What they don't tell you is how to get there. Well, of course, what we know gets you there is a plant-based diet, exercise, stress management, and the appropriate supplementation. So if you, what do I consider ideal? For a man, I consider 10 to 12% body fat is ideal. For a woman, between 12 and 14%. Now, I've done studies where we measure body mass index. We have an impedance machine and blood pressure. And almost always, the higher the amount of fat, the higher the blood pressure, the more elevated the cholesterol. And the average I see in people who have been following what they claim is some healthy protocol is around 27%. For overweight, around 40% for obese. And morbidly obese, it can go up over 50%, which is really challenging. So we have to change our perception of what it means to be overweight. We have to become more aware that, yes, love yourself. Yes, don't allow others to make you feel bad about the fact you're overweight for whatever reason. But remember, your brain will not rationalize any emotional justification. You will become more susceptible to Alzheimer's and losing your memory. Now, at all the retreats I do, I grow and serve sunflower sprouts, along with microgreens and other sprouts. If there was one seed that was superior in all of its nutrient bioavailability, it would be the sunflower. Sunflower butter, which is just sunflower seeds, have been ground into a smoother consistency. Sunflower seeds, raw or dry roasted at less than 120 degrees, which still preserves them and makes them very tasty, and they stay longer. And of course, the superstar, which is sunflower sprouts. That, in any of those forms, is terrific for you. This is from Natural News, and it says that the sunflower seeds, quote, are an excellent source of vitamin E, the body's primary fat-soluble antioxidant, and vitamin E plays a role in healthy cells, keeping free radicals from destroying the body, and hence sunflower seeds are listed on the site as one of the top 100 healthiest foods. Furthermore, this particular site that cites the most healthy foods talks about how it can lower your risk of a stroke, fewer muscle cramps, healthier nerves, better detoxification, better blood vessel health, lower blood pressure, less migraines and greater relief from migraines, all from having sunflowers. Also, the sunflower seed has 100 times the enzymes of full-grown greens, and that's terrific. And there's a lot of medicinal values in sunflowers, in any form that you take it. This was research done according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the University of Texas. So, what I like to do is every day in having a salad, and every day you can change the ingredients in the salad, but for your sprouts, always put your broccoli sprouts and sunflower sprouts. Those are the two superstars of the sprout family. And then if you get a jar of the raw sunflower paste or butter, always use the oil that's on top of it, because that's an unfiltered, unheated, unadulterated, pure oil. And that would go great on salads or put into a health shake as well. The Japanese have given us a lot of very healthy foods, miso, tofu, tempeh. Here's something else. This is from a study published in Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Quote, the effect of wasabi, W-A-S-A-B-I, there's a component in it, and it's called 6-methylsulfinylhexylisothiocyanate. That's a long word. But what it does, it ends up killing pancreatic cancer cells. And it's, by the way, if you go into any health food store, look for the Japanese horseradish, because that's wasabi. And if you have pancreatic cancer, use it. Put some of that into your smoothie because it's really powerful. It does not adversely affect any healthy cells, but it does kill cancer cells. A team of Japanese researchers studied the effects of this naturally occurring wasabi isolate. And in lay language, just write this down, 6-MITC. And two of its synthetic derivatives, 17447 and 17557, on human pancreatic cancer cells. And they use the pancreatic cells PANC1 and BXPC3. And they measured their responses to the wasabi, and they found the wasabi just killed the cancer cells. Now, mind you, pancreatic cancer is exceedingly difficult to treat through conventional methods, and they have a very poor outcome using orthodox treatments, mainly chemotherapy. So just something to give you some realistic alternative approaches to a very deadly cancer. But by the way, that imagine if you did that in conjunction with all the other natural therapies we have today, including the indole-3 carbinols and the IP6s and sulforaphanes, isothiocyanates. So we have Mitake diffraction. We have a whole lot of natural approaches to cancer. I'm only talking about one. Think of the synergy if you used a whole group of the others along with that. There's a procedure. It's called endoscopic. Since the death of noted entertainer Joan Rivers almost a year ago, the routine use of endoscopes has come under increased scrutiny. Now evidence has surfaced that contaminated endoscopes are behind many hospital outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant superbugs. But the FDA has known about this for years and done nothing. Now, some of these outbreaks have killed dozens and made hundreds sick. Now, the use of endoscopes has become the first diagnostic choice by a medical establishment that has literally lost touch with its patients and now relies almost exclusively on technology. Endoscopes are medical devices used to examine everything from the throat down to the colon, making the hands-on examination of the patient obsolete. And very similar devices are used for the popular colonoscopy, suggesting that these, too, are often highly contaminated with biological debris. And the design of these instruments makes them difficult to clean. Tiny crevices can trap matter that is not released during cleaning or exposed to disinfectants, putting the next patient on whom they are used at risk. Even when manufactured, cleaning instructions are followed to the letter. These are the instructions presented to and approved by the FDA during the approval process. But superbugs are pathogenic microorganisms, most often bacterium, that develop resistance to the medications normally used against them. Therefore, there is little or nothing to stop them once they get going. And one such very bad bacteria that is known to be spread directly by unclean endoscopes is known as CRE. And this CRE is really deadly. In fact, it has a kill rate of over 40%. So far, there have been 4 major outbreaks in hospitals in the U.S. And so just be aware of this, and wherever possible, tell your doctor you don't want to use that, or if you do, you want a brand new one, one that has never been used and cleaned, because there's just no way that they're going to have 100% autoclave cleansing of all these or disinfectant. We've had too many people dying because of this. And finally, how a compound in seaweed fights cancer and prevents metastasis. This is a good article given to us from Natural Health. It says, quote, Japan has some of the longest life expectancy averages in the world and some of the lowest incidences of chronic diseases common to the Western world. One of the most critical factors to their good health is the regular consumption of brown seaweed, rich in a compound known as fucoidine. And this chemical has had over 1,000 scientific studies, and it's known to have tremendous benefit. A, it suppresses inflammation. B, it promotes immunity. And so it can also slow down the spread of cancer. Now, here's what it says, quote, inhibiting cancer cell movement. The active ingredient in brown seaweed is a group of molecules that can be extracted from several seaweed species, including the Undaria, U-N-D-A-R-I-A. It's perhaps the most well-known source. Numerous scientific studies have shown that the nutrient has the ability to stop cancer cells from spreading throughout the body by inhibiting molecules known as selectins. The primary function of selectins is to facilitate the physical interaction and movement of various types of cells. The problem, however, is that cancer cells can take advantage of these molecules in spreading throughout the body. But this natural chemical has been shown to prevent cancer cells from adhering to the blood vessel walls and spreading. And hence, you can help prevent metastasis. So, the takeaway message, eat your brown seaweeds. There's a lot of different varieties. They all have this particular nutrient. It's very beneficial. Write it down. I will spell it for you. F-U-C-O-I-D-A-N. And it could save some lives. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. We have a lot more to go. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
Oh, the shark, baby, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, baby, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, baby, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting in our studios, New York City. Next week, we have Jesse Ventura coming up. We're going to talk to him about the legitimacy of conspiracies. We've taken about five that the media refuses to acknowledge as conspiracies, even though all of the actual evidence has been revealed showing they are conspiracies. Why is it that the mainstream media and the government refuses to even use the word conspiracy? Then we have Dr. Robert Weber. He is one of the most knowledgeable professors of psychology from Harvard Medical School. And we're going to focus upon aging and the elderly and creating programs for them to develop a more spiritual life in the latter years that contributes to society. And then we have Annie Jacobson, one of the top investigative journalists and scholars, who is known best for her work on DARPA and Area 51, more than anyone else I know in the United States. But she's going to focus on DARPA and its history as America's top secret military research agency and what goes on there and its influence over private military industry and new weapons of technology. So you're going to find a lot of new stuff there. And then Joanna Burke, professor of history at the University of London from the United Kingdom, we're going to have a conversation about how violence and war has become internalized in contemporary consciousness. And everything from the way we speak to the way children play and the way we personally identify with social characteristics to guns and weapons. And also we'll have Roy Scranton on next week, an Iraqi war veteran, journalist, and PhD at Princeton, whose experience of war and death in the Middle East made him realize the dangers of climate change and the likely end of civilization as we know it in the future. He is the author of Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. So there's just some of the people we have coming on next week. And in about 10 minutes now, we'll be going to my guest, David Reif, talking about political and developmental failures to tackle global poverty and hunger. I want to share this with you also. I was having a discussion yesterday about why I am against all equity partnerships, because these, in my personal opinion, are economic genocidalists. Here's how it works. They find a company, either a well-run company that has no debt, or a company that is hemorrhaging, and they can take advantage of it because it has something they want, like a proprietary name. And then they go in and they have another party do all their homework and research, provide the bridge capital so they can buy it. They generally pay far more for it than what it's worth, but that far more than what it's worth is what they take as their commissions up front, so they never lose. And then now the company they bought is loaded with debt, and debt in a time when people are not buying as much, and therefore they can't service the debt. And therefore they start to strip off the employees, take the pensions. They simply rip it to pieces, and they sell off the parts. After all, let's just say hypothetically that you bought a company like Alcoa. Well, it doesn't matter where it's manufactured. The aluminum, what you want is you want the name, because that's what people are buying. They're buying a brand. So what if you bought the company and then closed down its plants and the living wage people are earning that have been in a location for 100 years, and you ship it off to China, where they're going to get cheap labor, and then you own that title, so when you bring it back in, you're going to have more profit in the marketplace. That's how they work. All right, these are not nice people. So I was talking about why people should not have voted. One of the many reasons they shouldn't have voted for Romney in the last election, because of his ownership in Bain Capital. And he said, well, what about Bain Capital? And so let me just show you one example. This was not brought up in the different debates and should have been. For example, he earned $12 million from GS Industries, but then fired 750 people. They lost their jobs. He earned $83 million from KB Toys and caused 3,500 jobs to be lost. He made $242 million from Dade International, a medical supply firm, and they cut 1,700 jobs. He made $40 million from DDI Corporation, which plummeted and cost 275 jobs. All told, about 6,000 jobs lost during the period Romney claims he was not the CEO, but still acted as such. Other Bain examples, $10 million on Stage Stores, collected $184 million in stocks and went bankrupt. And all these others, like American Pad and Paper, invested $5 million, collected $107 million, and it went bankrupt. He bought Details, invested $40 million, collected $70 million in stock, and it went bankrupt. Based on a Harvard study, before after buyouts, there's also a sharp rise in unemployment and higher job destruction. So that's what these people do. So, and these are the people who frequently fund campaigns. They want to make sure that the people they get in positions of power don't regulate them. So it's making sure they control the regulatory process. The agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, USDA, they want to make sure that their people are in positions of power, and thus far they're winning. So when you hear the name equity partnerships, understand those people are going to make a buck. And they don't care who suffers, and people do suffer. Now, for all of us who are activists, all of us who every day take on an issue, whatever our motivation, because we feel morally inclined to speak truth to injustice, because we're outraged at discrimination or the inequalities, whatever your motivation, just understand now you are a target. Now, you've been a target, but now you're officially a target. This is from Washington Blog. quote, intelligence services block activists' emails and frame them with fake emails. You send an email to a reporter saying that you've got proof of criminal wrongdoing by a government official or big bank. You never receive a response. Or you send an email to an expert on monetary policy asking if the Federal Reserve policies help the rich at the expense of the little guy. Or an expert on radiation asking if Fukushima accident might endanger public health. You never receive a response. This might be for any number of perfectly innocent reasons, including your email ended up in their spam folder, they're busy, they're not interested enough to write back, they think you're a bore or a crank. But there is another explanation. Way back, China has blocked Gmails for its citizens. Yahoo blocked emails related to Occupy protest. Bahrain uses British software that allows the government to frame political activists by creating messages from that person that they never typed. 35 other countries used the same software. Tunisia monitored and blocked the emails of activists, so they were never delivered. For example, there is also technical surveillance whereby downloading or adding attachments to an email must go through a central server. And under the pretext of protecting public order and national security, a 1998 post and telecommunications law enables the authorities to intercept and check the complete content of every email message. And in fact, electronic surveillance such as filtering of email messages and government opponents have been reported. So they're doing that across the board and in the United States, too. So just be aware that every single email that you give on any issue that challenges corporatism, the neoliberalism, the government corruption, you're now considered an enemy of the state. Here's a doctor, a medical doctor, giving us a short but very interesting response as to why he never recommends his patients drink cow's milk.
When you think about it, the purpose of cow's milk, I did most of my growing up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. The purpose of cow's milk is to turn a 65-pound calf into a 400-pound cow as rapidly as possible. Cow's milk is baby calf growth fluid. That's what this stuff is. Everything in that white liquid, the hormones, the lipids, the proteins, the sodium, the growth factors, the IGF, all, every one of those is meant to blow that calf up to a great big cow. It wouldn't be there. And whether you pour it on your cereal as a liquid, whether you clot it into yogurt, whether you eat it into cheese, whether you freeze it into ice cream, it's baby calf growth fluid. And women eat it, and it stimulates their tissues, and it gives women breast lumps. It makes the uterus get big, and they get fibroids, and they bleed, and they get hysterectomies, and they need mammograms, and gives guys man boobs. This is, cow's milk is the lactation secretions of a large bovine mammal who just had a baby. It's for baby calves. You know, I tell my patients, go look in the mirror. Do you have big ears? Do you have a tail? Are you a baby calf? If you're not, don't be eating baby calf growth fluid in any level. There's nothing in it people need.
Okay. It's that simple. But it's interesting to hear a physician who says why he doesn't recommend it, and he is right. Humans need nothing from any animal. So just don't eat anything with a heartbeat or a face. Now, anytime we hear about the conflict in the Middle East, the United States and all of its senators, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, line up behind Israel, which is their right to do so. None of them line up behind the Palestinians. And we're not talking about the Palestinians who are committing crimes against humanity or are acting as terrorists, but the average Palestinian. We don't go into their homes. We don't see if they have a home, and 100,000 have been made homeless because of 10,000 homes destroyed. The media stays clear of that third rail, so you never hear it. All you hear about are people selected by AIPAC, which is the American Jewish Lobby Group, to defend Israel no matter what it is intending, including its intent to do a preemptive strike against Iran. big mistake if they did that, but they're more than capable of doing that. So here is a former Zionist. Here's a person that was not just Jewish, and there's a big difference between Judaism and Zionism. And if you doubt me, I have a whole lot of Orthodox rabbis you should speak with who will give you an education in the difference of the two. So this is a Zionist, Sir Gerald Kaufman, speaking about what it means for him to visit the West Bank and Gaza and then the average neighborhoods in Israel and his perception now at this point in his life.
Say, George, I grew up a supporter of the State of Israel. I was brought up as a Zionist. I went to Israel again and again and again on holiday. I had family there. I had friends there. But as I traveled around, because it's a small area, I would see not just Israelis in Israel, living in huge comfort, subsidized by the Americans. I would see settlers in the illegal settlements living in huge comfort. And minutes away, I would go to a Palestinian township or village and see sewage flowing through the streets. And if you have any sense of justice at all, and as a Jewish child, I was brought up with a sense of justice. The disparity is unacceptable. And it's got worse. It's got worse and worse and worse the whole time. And the Israelis live in comfort. I've gone through Tel Aviv and see them sitting at their pavement cafes, complacently enjoying themselves, while hardly any distance away, people in the Gaza Strip are living in total misery, but don't let's forget the people on the West Bank. They're living in misery as well.
There is
a huge difference between the apartheid that the Israelis are inflicting on the Palestinians and the loathsome and odious apartheid that existed in South Africa. There were distances, considerable distances, between Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, and the South African townships. In Palestine, it's minutes between the settlements or between Israel behind the 67 borders and the hell that they've created in Gaza and on the West Bank. So it's worse. It's worse even than the foul actions of the South African apartheid government. You've got to make these people feel it. I'm not optimistic, but I'm realistic. Nobody ever expected the Soviet Union to collapse in the way that it did, but it happened. Nobody ever expected apartheid in South Africa to collapse in the way that it
did,
but it
happened. What we
need and what I press for and will go on pressing for is governments, the United Nations, the European Union, the United States, our own country, to impose economic sanctions so that the Israelis can feel what international opinion means. There's no point in condemning them. There's certainly no point in appealing to their better nature because they don't have a better nation. You've got to make them suffer because that's the only way they will feel anything. And economic sanctions would erode this huge first world standard of living which they enjoy on borrowed money.
Summer,
because there wasn't enough electricity for air conditioning in nearby Tel Aviv, they cut off the electricity in the Gaza Strip, and Qatar had to intervene and see what it could do, which wasn't enough. No building materials are brought in, so that the schools that the Israelis destroyed, in some cases with children in them, cannot be rebuilt. Medical facilities are at their minimum. If any other country on earth was doing what the Israelis have been doing to 1.7 million Palestinians in Gaza, There will be United Nations resolutions, there will be calls for intervention, there will be sanctions, but the Israelis literally get away with
and
murder.
And
every politician pretty well in the United States yields to the Jewish pressure groups, and that's why they daren't do anything about it, even if they wanted to do something about it. The European Union is inactive. The British government is inactive. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, described the Gaza Strip as a prison camp. Most of my parents' families, because my parents came here as refugees, most of my parents' families were murdered in the Holocaust. When the Germans came to the town from which my mother came in Poland, Staszów, they lined up all the Jews to march to the railway station to be put in cattle wagons. But for those who were not well enough to march, they killed them on the spot. And they killed my grandmother, who was ill in bed, by shooting her in her bed. My grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israelis murdering Palestinian grandmothers.
Something to think about. At least another voice, since we seem to have zero voices in this discussion and looking for peace for both nations. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go to our guest standing by, David Reif. That's R-I-E-F-F, policy analyst specializing in immigration, international military conflicts, and humanitarian efforts. He is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute at the New School for Social Research, New York City, and a fellow at the New York Institute for Humanities at New York University. And he's also a board member at Human Rights Watch and was a project participant in the Open Society Institute. And he's the only son of the famous American author Susan Sontag, and he is a graduate of Princeton University. He's written a lot of articles, and his latest of over a dozen books, The Reapproach of Hunger, Food, Justice, and Money in the 21st Century. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
David, when we look at the task ahead of relieving global poverty and hunger, we're faced with an enormously complex problem with a huge variety of interrelated parties and interests involved. We've increasingly private business interests such as resource acquisition, private investments, and trading in commodities, most important being food. And there are philanthropic interests such as the Gates Foundation that are part of this. And there are UN development interests to improve sustainability and livelihoods in the developing countries. And there are geopolitical interests, not just from the U.S., but increasingly from China as well. And all these converge to create atmospheres that can either be successful in relieving poverty and hunger or make matters worse. On top of that, there is global warming and climate change and the growing threat of wars and conflicts over dwindling natural resources. There will be millions of victims. We're also being told that international efforts to reduce hunger are succeeding. Bill Gates and Bono would have us believe this. I do not. But how truthful from your perspective are these claims when we look at the actual figures? So I feel it's a good place to start by sharing with us the real conditions of global poverty and hunger in the world today. And is the battle being won or lost? And are those who make the claim that the war on hunger is being won really looking carefully at what looms on the horizon regarding the future of food security and climate change?
Well, listen, to be utterly candid with you, if I knew the answers to all those questions, I would do more than write a book. I mean, I'm for king of the world. I have no idea how things are going to turn out, obviously. We don't know. I mean, there are a bunch of things we don't know. Let's start with the obvious. We don't know at how much global warming there's going to be. Is it going to be kept to more or less 2.5 Celsius, which scientists think, in average, which scientists think is, how to put it, manageable? Or is the nightmare scenario of that, 4 or 5 degrees Celsius going to happen? In which case, all the things you outline, resource wars, migration that will make what's going on in Europe now look like nothing. A whole series of other things, like environmental, that is survival of the planet, in short. in livable form for human beings. I don't know which way it's going to turn out, and I certainly don't trust. I mean, I'm pessimistic by temperament, so that I think imposes on me a particular duty not to let my pessimism cloud my judgment. But obviously, one scenario is very grim indeed. As far as where poverty is it's a mixed bag, to be honest with you. On the one hand, there has been one amazing success, and that is the diminution, the radical diminution over the course of the second half of the 20th century and the first 15 years of the 21st, of famine. There have been terrible famines, but if you actually look at the statistics of how many people die in famine, even in the few places where famine still exists, above all in the Horn of Africa, in North Korea, and a couple of other parts of the world, you'll see that that famine has diminished. This is a tremendous accomplishment. On the other hand, I would argue that, and do argue in this book, that the notion that under the current system of business-dominated international system, that the idea that we're really going to, that it will be possible to end extreme poverty and hunger, which is the claim that people like Gates and Bono and the Secretary General of the United Nations Fund and many others make, and Jeffrey Sachs, I mean, the list is very long and very distinguished. Serious people, many of them, not all of them, but many of them. If they think of that there's been some poverty reduction, which there has, if you look, for example, at statistics about child mortality, there are a lot of countries where things are somewhat better. I don't think they're quite as rosy as sometimes described, but they're somewhat better. But first of all, we have a billion people who haven't been, anywhere near not enough to eat or have been raised out of poverty, although they've had some hurt. And I think that's because the model is broken. That I don't see how business, which is fundamentally about profit, has suddenly become sort of innately virtuous, and that's the claim that is more and more being made. In effect, we've weakened the state and strengthened business. And what you're seeing in development and campaigns against poverty is, if you like, the last place where the state and NGOs and the like were more powerful than business, private sector, and privatization. You see that area falling under the sway of business as well. I think this is just a grave error in so many different ways. But we're very far along down that path, and until it's shown to fail, or until some counter movement arises to dispute territory with it, if you like, it'll go on like this.
You have been researching humanitarian developmental aid for over 30 years, and as you write, today's food crisis is man-made. You just alluded to it. What, in your estimation, has been the causes for the largest failures in their efforts to meet their goals and lessen hunger and create more socially sustainable societies in the poorer countries? And can you address the problem of commodity trading, which I believe should be outlawed? I do not believe anyone except the government should regulate the price of commodity that is essential to life, so you wouldn't have all this speculation, which we've seen massive amounts of, and getting these private corporations who do not make a profit by giving us more crops, by controlling the price of seeds and controlling the price of water, and in other words, privatizing to point where their economic goals are what are really important, not whether people starve. Could you give us your solution to this, please?
Well, what's extraordinary is the degree to which corporations want to have it both ways. They want to say that they're in it for their shareholders, and they want to say that they can, what they're doing is also good for everybody, and that there's absolutely no contradiction. And when you say, you say to them, privately or publicly, well, the history of corporations is not one to inspire confidence on that line. They just accuse you of cynicism or leftism or whatever strikes them at the moment, and basically say, you know, almost like a kind of revivalist meeting, that you haven't heard the good news. So I think that, you know, I think first of all, they assume that they control the story. The one solution, if you want to talk about solutions, is to dispute the story that philanthrocapitalism will save the world. This term used not by critics of business-led development, but by supporters of it, and one, you know, word that people use shamelessly, in my view. But anyway, look, the real question here, from my perspective, is that the problem isn't food supply. The problem isn't whether we can produce enough food for 10 or 12 billion people, which is what the world will have by getting a sex center. The problem is politics and justice. And it's precisely because business-led development posits development as an engineering problem, fundamentally. There are these problems that have to be solved. Instead of thinking of it as a politics where people have to argue and, you know, have to present very different views and compete. There's a kind of, if you like, it's kind of Francis Fukuyama gone mad. It's, we all agree about the politics. We all agree that liberal capitalism is best, it's the only system that can make people happy and not poor. And therefore, so we have these problems out there in the developing world, world, and we'll just get our best minds to deal with them. This is such a misstatement of reality that one scarcely knows where to begin.
Well, I certainly appreciate the scholarship and the detail and the positive solutions that you offer in The Reapproach of Hunger. It's a sobering look. I personally believe that the world population is headed towards a future that will be more devastating than we can imagine. I don't have any faith in the new green revolution. It has been co-opted, and the genetic engineering is just insane, but I do have a lot of faith in getting back to the basics of real sustainable agriculture, which can work and is working and has historically worked, but also in the new framework of where are there places where people simply should not live. You know, you can no longer in this world say, well, we've always been here, so we're going to always stay here, and we're going to say, well, you always had water, now you don't. So we have to be looking at, is the environment a person living in, is it sustainable? And if not, where can we help these people go where they are not just loose migrants wandering like vagabonds, but actually have a place to go to and support from the state to have a quality life. And I think that's where we should be putting a lot of our energy. David, thank you very much. All the best on this new work. It's deeply, deeply important that people read this work called Reapproach of Hunger by David Reif, R-I-E-F-F. Thank you very much, Dave, for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And finally today, tonight I'm going to be hosting a premiere for our sister station, WBAI, to help the station pay its bills. Here is what we're doing. Just from this point forward until 7 o'clock tonight at 86, the church does not allow, we're showing it in the church, the church has not allowed you to pay cash there. So you got to call my office, and they'll tell you where you'd go to pay your pay to get into it, because you can't bring money at the church and get in. There's always people who say, I don't have credit cards and I don't have checks. Fine, you'll be able to pay. And there's only a little block walk, a couple blocks between where you have to pay and coming in. Separately, we are now out of books. And so what I'm doing is the fee to get in tonight, where you'll watch the movie and get a copy of the film to take home with you, is $30. We have been offering it for $49.95, but you get a copy of the book. The trouble is, PEI, it didn't order enough books. So, okay, we will have the books, as many as that were purchased by the station manager, but the price for anyone not receiving the book is $30. And there's only one place to go now to get in. If you want to join us, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and you will get a copy of the film. You will watch the film. You'll be there for the presentation afterwards. And it's going to be a wonderful evening. It'll be an Empower evening, so you don't want to miss it. All right? And it's only $30 if you're not getting the book. But we don't have enough books, and unfortunately, it was just poor planning. So that's that. Now, we're going to go out with this, and I hope all the stations at least spend a minute playing this. Context, a 9-year-old girl, no voice lessons, no teachers, no mentors. She simply listened to music and taught herself how to sing. Here is her performance. What a voice. Have a nice weekend, everyone.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend